Do I have my panelists here? I think Peter just walked in, I see. Okay. Michael, I saw earlier. Lee, Leonard, great. Well, we've accomplished a lot already. Good morning, and thank you, Jeff. And again, I want to welcome everybody on behalf of Defined Health, the Cancer Progress. And I want to welcome you to the Buzzkill panel. Okay. This is a somewhat unconventional way to start this meeting. We usually do this on day two, after we review all the scientific progress and after Jeff has put up those spectacular numbers showing the revenues and the explosion in the cancer market. And many people in the room, particularly those with pharmaceutical companies, probably look at those with a certain degree of excitement. These guys look at it with a certain degree of dread. Okay, a lot of them. And I think we all have to start to look at it, perhaps not with excitement, perhaps not with dread, but as a symptom of a problem that we need to fix. So before I introduce the panelists, which I'm actually not going to do because, my goodness, they require no introduction, just to set the context and to say that it's important to us in a meeting that for the rest of the 2 days is going to really review substantial advances in the progress against cancer. Defined Health acquired this meeting from Communitech 4 years ago, and it turned out purely by luck that seemed to be an inflection point. That seemed to be the point where we really turned a corner. And actually, when we review and we sit in these panels and we look at progress against all these various different tumors, both on the solid side and the hematological side, it's pretty astounding. So we need to have this panel because we need to figure out how we are going to pay for it. Now, a little bit of a pop quiz, and then we'll get right on to it. Let me give you two observers of the problem or of the industry, and, you know, can we afford progress in cancer? Well, this guy said, quote, "What you know is not going to happen is the ability to stack therapies on top of each other at the current price and expect people to pay. The whole oncology pricing structure needs to be rethought because it's reached a level that is not going to be sustainable for the long term." Does anyone know who said that? Would you guess that it was one of these guys? Would that be your guess? Would anybody guess that it was the CEO of what is today the world's largest global pharmaceutical company, Novartis? Sorry, Pfizer, but by evaluate pharma, they've eclipsed you. That was Joe Jimenez. CEO of Novartis said that in May 2014. Here's the second quote. "The big opportunity out there is really in cancer. If we can get out in front of that, that is a huge opportunity." These guys? They're a little warm. The guy who said that is actually a guy named George Paz, who's the CEO of a prescription benefit management company called Express Scripts. And he was actually talking about his first target after having brought down the pricing in HCV. His second target is the about-to-be-launched PCSK9s, which you've been reading a lot about. But he's looking forward to cancer. Okay. Now I will actually quote, hopefully correctly, some of the people up here who are fabulous. I'll start with Lee. Okay. Lee said within relatively recent, I think this is within a year, so I don't think it changed. Probably all these numbers have gone up if it was a year ago. "For cancer care at UnitedHealthcare, we spend about 24% of our budget on drugs, which are inflated at about 15% per year." Is that about still right, Lee? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Some of those things that Jeff showed you, probably increasing it. "Hospitals get more than half of the dollar at about 54%, and physician fees make up the other 22%, the only sector of spending that is actually at negative inflation, physician fees. Okay. So he goes on to say, if you want to ask for the potential for savings, where do we want to start? Segue, this is Peter. Okay, Peter said, don't get nervous, this is what Peter said. Okay, he says a lot, and it's usually right on the point. So if you want to ask where there's potential for savings, where do we want to start thinking about bundles? Where are there entities that could save money by getting lump sums for all the drugs they use? Bach answers his question by saying, quote, you go to the places where there are huge profit margins. And in his mind, that means hospitals. That's what it says. Quote, hospitals have balance sheets and are getting fantastic reimbursements, so they're exactly the ones to target for savings. I happen to work in a hospital. These are serious players. Okay. So maybe it's not a drug problem. Maybe it's a hospital problem. Okay. And then, Leonard, can I call you Len, Leonard, Dr. Saltz? I'm so
yes,
good to
all
have
of
you.
The above.
Okay. Describe the situation this way. We're in a situation where cancer diagnosis is one of the leading causes of personal bankruptcy. We're starting to see the term, quote, financial toxicity, unquote, being used in the literature. And Mike, I'm sorry, I couldn't find a quote, so I told you, I warned you before, you're going to have to give me a good one. Okay. Aetna keeps a really tight rein on him.
People have heard me speak, find that almost laughable. But
we'll get it. All right.
Right.
Okay. So the focus here is going to be on Rx costs, the ones that are inflating at 15% a year, because that's kind of what we're talking about, these drugs in this. But I wanted to importantly set the context. There's probably the health economists up here probably have a much more recent citation, but I found this particularly fascinating. And it's actually kind of interesting when we talk about financial toxicity. This actually was published in Health Affairs back in 2006, and it was a study of elasticities, that sort of this percentage change in use associated with a 1% increase in effective coinsurance rates of drugs. Okay? This is so interesting, because if you do that, or more four conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, kidney disease, multiple sclerosis, and cancer, okay? Goldman reported that if insurance plan were to double the cost of sharing for rheumatoid arthritis specialty drugs, overall spending on these drugs would decrease by 21%. Now, that's a while ago. It may be more now. However, for cancer drugs, spending would be decreased by only 1%, okay? Clearly, the tools we've had and are not going to work. This is in contrast to traditional pharmaceuticals, where a 30 to 50% decrease in spending can be seen when copayments double. Okay? So this is the problem. Is this the button that advances me? Daryl, help. Okay, it's this one. Great. Thanks. So here's our problem. Okay? That's the background there. It's in front, Peter, if you want to. Assuming your eyes are good enough to see that. These are the cancer drugs that were approved since we last had this type of discussion at Cancer Progress 2014. Okay? So starting with, and just read it. Okay? Just read it. So that is my introduction. I'm going to go back to the, is there another, there might be another one. Oh, yeah. It keeps going. That's why all these numbers are going up, Jeff. Okay, and I'm going to go back here and kick this discussion off by, first of all, did I quote you guys right? And then I'll sit down and we'll have a discussion going. And open to the audience, as Ginny said, we have enthusiastic and rapid mic runners. We have about 45 minutes for a great discussion, and we'll kick it off. Okay, so. Let me kick this off a little bit. Hopefully I've laid out the fact that, you know, we have to fix this. We have a problem, right? It has to be fixed. Just we cannot go on the way we're going on. We can't keep on keeping on. We have a variety of approaches that everybody talks about that almost become sound bites. Value-based pricing, episode-based pricing, risk-sharing agreements. I think what we want to do for this panel is really get as I don't want to get especially geeky about it, but we want to stay, not really get into the weeds, but talk about, you know, timing and impact and how we're going to get our hands around this problem, okay? It's very easy, I think, and perhaps it's even appropriate to throw the responsibility at the foot of the pharmaceutical industry, but we live in a country and we live in a complex medical care delivery system where there are so many factors that contribute here. So how are we going to talk about the problem and how we're going to fix it? Anybody start? Nobody on this panel is shy. I know that.
Go. Yep.
Sure.
Let's go.
Good morning. I object to being called the buzzkill. I do think there...
I called you that last year, too.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it was more suitable last year. I do think there's a risk that the party is nearly over, but not quite. I mean, the cops are lining up on the street. Maybe the house lights are on, but the party's still raging, at least those few people. But I think that, you know, I actually think broken markets are bad, and that they're bad ultimately for innovation, and they're bad for patients, and they're bad for just this sort of natural development of an efficient economy. And we have a broken market for drugs, and actually don't hold the industry responsible. The industry is responding to the rules as they've been set, some of which they've had a chance to influence, some of which they haven't. But nevertheless, this is exactly what you'd expect in an environment where all the laws point to you can charge whatever you want for a compound and nobody can exclude it from coverage. There are solutions. I think they're going to be difficult for us to swallow, but I think we either need to set up more sort of natural or somewhat natural competition between products when we have products or regimens that can compete, or we need an external price fixing, and that price fixing needs to be linked to value. And those are going to be very hard steps to take from where we've been today. I will make a technical point, not to be too geeky, but you can't look at those slides and think about these drugs by the drug. You have to think of the drug married to the indication, because these drug agents are very different in terms of their efficacy or even their crude cost effectiveness, depending on how they're used and with which drugs. And if we want to get to stacked therapies, if we want to get to having a drug that works minimally effectively in one condition, but we still want it because it is effective, and maximally effective in another, and we want to have anything close to value, we're going to need to tweak the system so that we can pay differentially for those drugs. Very hard to do right now in the U.S. for a variety of reasons, including all sorts of weird stuff like ASP calculations, Medicaid best price and stuff, but that's where we need to get.
So, go ahead.
I'm just going to break it down as one who doesn't have near as much economics background as most of the people on this panel. It's got to be broken down with a solution that somebody like me can understand, because one of the ways we've gotten into this problem is by having such a complex system that it takes years to try to ferret through it and figure out what the heck is going on. At the end of the day, it's a disconnect between cost and value, and a broken market is a simple way to put it. In a market that's functioning, value would be linked to cost. There are many impediments that will have to be moved out of the way in order to reconnect these two, and they're all going to hurt, and there's going to be objection on somebody's part to anything that can fix the problem. It's a matter of getting a collective understanding that the word unsustainable does have meaning, and that we can't expect that some of those lofty graphs that were shown in the introductory talk really can happen. Those are all making assumptions that business will be as usual and that the current standard can continue. I think that's unrealistic.
Yeah, let's just do some basic consumer arithmetic here. If I just heard a talk by Sam Glick out of Oliver Wyman, who did a beautiful job in displaying the fact for me that one out of three Americans is going to be buying a different insurance product than they bought just 3 years ago. So in 3 years, the market's going to shift dramatically. Excuse me, most of that will go to private exchanges. So they're going to be buying a different product. They will be buying it through a channel that didn't exist 3 years ago. And about 30% of their spend is going to be discretionary. So what's happening already as we see them get into the exchanges is they're buying cheap. Where it used to be when I sell to an employer, they want good benefit packages. They want their employee to have a reasonable, I'll use that in quotes, amount of financial responsibility. But when the consumer is given a budget and told to go out and buy his own product, she will buy very, very cheap. And as a result, the average deductible in the United States is rising now up to about $1,400. So you just see it's going straight up the more exchanges become in place. And the consumer is becoming very aware of what it costs to buy health care, whereas they weren't before. It already today costs over 50% of the average U.S. household income to buy your plan and pay your out-of-pocket expenses. Now, nobody knew that because the employer or the government was covering the vast majority of that expense. But in the exchanges, they become very aware of it. Now they're seeing the whole bill because they're writing the check They're still getting some money from their employer, but they are seeing the entire bill. And so the only final piece I'd say to that is that in America, this is the United States, 50% of U.S. households can't get their hands on $2,000 cash in 1 month. Okay. 50%. This is from the National Bureau of Economic Research. So if half of America has a deductible that's around $1,500 and rising, and they can't find $2,000 for a new transmission or a medical emergency, we have a bit of a problem. And now we're talking about drugs that are $13,000, $15,000 a month. So they're not buying good coverage anymore. They're beginning to lower that premium, so there's less coverage there. That means more of the money comes out of their pocket and they don't have it. At least half of America doesn't. So the other half still has a market, but they too are shrinking because they too are feeling the same crunch that the lower half of the market is. So now I sound like an economics professor, but we've got a problem and we have to figure out how to get total costs down.
So I work for an insurance company, but I'm not really an insurance guy. You know, I'm an oncologist, and I was in the trenches in community practice for a long time. And the truth of the matter is that the old way insurance was, the new way insurance was, patients getting active treatment for cancer blow through their deductible, like in the first month, and then you got insurance, right? Except if you don't have insurance. So, you know, from the everyman's perspective, we have, I think, two major issues. One issue is we have become so comfortable paying for very marginal incremental improvement that now that we have actually substantial incremental improvement, we don't know how to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So we are a victim of that process. So we gave a 30% increment to the second ALK drug, and now we've got Optivo, and people are freaking. But Optivo is, like, way better than the second ALK drug.
Right.
I mean, everybody can agree with that. So that's our first problem. The second problem is this. We want a market solution, but we won't let the market solve the problem. Right? Comparative effectiveness would help things a lot. Yeah, I know you guys hate to hear that term, but the truth of the matter is, I went to school in Missouri. Show me. Show me you're better. Prove it. Right? Prove it. Lee and I totally agree that our job is not to say no. In fact, my job is to make sure the right person gets the treatment, right? Mm-hmm. So help us. Biomarkers are wonderful things. Biomarkers are wonderful things. And yet, what we're going to have, I know this is true, we're going to have 8 PD-1, PD-L1 drugs, and all of them are going to be going for the same market because you can't help yourself. It's so attractive. So much money to be made, and not a single one will have a biomarker that's worth a damn. And that's an embarrassment, right? That's an embarrassment. Now, I'm not saying your scientists are dumb or anything, but if you spend a lot more money on discovery instead of 14 trials that we just saw from Jeff combining Optivo with everything, including Lord's water, we might get a little further along. Was that controversial enough for you, Ed?
Yeah, thank that you. Was. Thank you. See, that always works. Okay, well, let's stay on that point, and we'll proceed in sort of a semi-organized, coherent manner, because I think we all recognize there's a problem. And clearly there are, perhaps, if we don't get those biomarkers, perhaps George Paz at Express Scripts, which, by the way, in case anybody's interested, I should tell you that their revenues are actually much higher than the pharma company revenues. Remember years ago, pharma companies bought these prescription benefit managers? Now I'm sorry I don't have this slide, but so only the guys up here can see it, but the big green bars are 2 to 3 times larger than the pharma orange bars in terms of revenues, and mostly in terms of market value. So these are formidable institutions. And they have formidable power, as they've already showed in the HCV environment. So everybody's looking at the PCSK9s, and I counted 8 present PD-1s reported in ADIS R&D as being anywhere from phase 1 to 3, okay, just getting ready to join the fray. But as Peter's pointed out, and you did this last year in a really good way, just because another drug comes out, the Me Too model doesn't never prevails in oncology, right? It'll find a different population. It'll find a, you know, it will go someplace else, and it'll probably be higher priced. At least that's the history. So do we begin to break the arc of that now because of the crowding in these areas?
Well, that's exactly the point I was talking about. It's a dimension of the broken marketplace, and Mike points to me because I've written a lot about this ALK space, but mm-hmm. we know this for quite a long time now, that the follow-ons to Gleevec cost more than Gleevec, mm-hmm. right? And Novartis, the maker of Gleevec's response was to raise the price of Gleevec up to the follow-on's price. I mean, that's really upside down from any market perspective. And we have a crowding into this ALK space and adeno for the lung, and, you know, again, that's a pretty narrow indication. There's at least 10 drugs in human trials now for that space, another four in pre-human development. So, you know, this is very crowded for a narrow indication, and part of the reason is the signal the manufacturers are getting is that there's going to be no price competition, which is why they rush into those spaces. It's, again, a logical decision given the broken market. But the problems with that are legion. One is we would like to have competition. It would be good. If we had eight immuno-oncology drugs coming along, that would be a bonanza for competition. It would ultimately be good for patients. It would be lower premiums and things like that if we could have natural competition or even somewhat artificial competition. It's Mike's interesting putting Zycadia, Novartis's product, against Opdivo. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a pretty big stretch to be comparative around, but still, that would be the idea. So if Express Scripts, and by the way, I have mm-hmm. to complain, as I think pharma people will as well, mm-hmm. revenues is not a reasonable way to measure
right. oh, but,
companies
right.
that have, you know, where a lot of the money is cash flow, right? So, or it's pass-through money.
Right.
So Express Scripts,
correct.
And I'm not defending them,
no.
but they're fundamentally an insurer,
correct.
Right, or an intermediary. That's very different from, let's say, looking at the revenues of a pharma company where the gross margins are, you know, quite broad. So, and I'm not saying they're big or small or anything. That's a common complaint about insurers mm-hmm. as well, right? So is that
yeah.
they have smaller profit margins than mm-hmm. the drug company or it's sort of a misrepresentation.
But
anyway,
Peter, okay. you make an important point though, and I'm not unaware of that. But I think that the other slide, and I wish I could show it to you, it's actually on the Define Health website. Actually looks at the market values, looks at the market capitalization of these companies.
Yeah, that's a better metric.
As a function. And frankly, Express Scripts, which I pretty much think, and one of the insurance folks over here can correct me if I'm wrong, which is pretty much a pure PBM, okay? They don't think they don't write insurance policies, right? They're a pure PBM. They manage prescription costs. As opposed to these guys who have PBMs or relationships with PBMs as part of their structure. Express Scripts actually, on a market value, is on a revenue, they're much larger than Merck. On a market value, they're much less. But I would submit to you that a lot of what's going on here is the thought about competition for margins. So we hear about budget impact, maybe about margins. But
I want to point out, I'm going to try to move us off Express Scripts and
mm-hmm.
the like, simply
yeah.
because I think this is exactly how we fail to solve the problem.
Okay.
That's almost a different discussion for a different group on mm-hmm. a different day. Because if we say, oh, actually, the problem is they're charging too much or they're making too much,
mm-hmm.
we miss what I think is the central point of this panel, which is those lofty projections that you saw Jeff
right.
put up on the screen before, we're saying can't be true,
right.
can't be right, and we're looking at how can we change that.
Right.
Now, you're thinking, well, my job is to do just the opposite. And I'm saying, no, the answer is somewhere in the middle,
mm-hmm.
that if all those projections come through, what that means is there is no containment on the cost, there is no reduction in the number of people who are getting the drug, there is no useful exclusionary biomarker that can be used to say, this is not the right person, don't treat this person. Well, that's a customer that just dropped off, and then the amount of money spent drops. Ultimately, to solve the problem, we have to do one of two things or a little bit of both, which is either lower the price and the profit margin within the individual drug or lower the market that drug is going to, lower the number of people who are getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about biomarkers, there are two types, and people get lost in this discussion. I think it's really important to keep it clear. One is the prognostic biomarker, those are a wonderful way to further increase the cost of health care without providing any benefit whatsoever. And this is what most of the biomarker work out there is about. Okay? This is Oncotype DX in colon cancer. Okay? Completely useless expenditure of money that I, as a person who takes care of human beings with colon cancer, have no use for whatsoever. All it does is raise some serum catechol level a little bit. It can give you a warm and fuzzy feeling, or it can give you a cold chill down your spine, but it isn't going to help you make a decision. As opposed to, say, something like a RAS mutation, which can tell you don't use this EGFR inhibitor in a colon cancer patient. It will not work. In fact, it might even hurt. Okay? Those are true exclusionary markers. They're very useful from an oncologic perspective. They're bad for business. BMS wishes we never discovered it. Actually, they discovered it. They thought it was going to get them a frontline market share. It didn't work out that way. But those are the kinds of things, in order to create credibility with these drugs, that we're going
to
need.
And we do have another way to attack that problem that, in addition to the two Len mentioned, and that is just parse out the stuff that doesn't have any value at all. And there's a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Or so, actually, not any value at all, but so little value.
Or any, even. Well, yeah. I'll take both.
Okay.
Because I think you're right. We did an experiment with five medical oncology groups where we gave the oncologist a financial incentive to do just that. And we would share a little bit of it with them, provided that they also were willing to be measured on all the outcomes measures. They had to do as well as fee-for-service. And not only did they match the survivals, they markedly improved the quality by reducing hospitalizations for toxicity. And so with a group of 800 patients, they took 34% of the expense out of taking care of a cancer patient, dropped the cost by a third just by paying attention. So there's a huge opportunity out there if we will be careful about getting rid of the things that really don't help and spend more time on preventing things that are expensive that we could actually avert. But that involves changing the incentives around, as Peter and both Len have said. Mm-hmm. And we can do that.
So let me tell you why that math is problematic. If you look at the total cost of care annualized of a patient receiving systemic therapy for malignancy, total cost, historically it's been in the $100,000 range. That's annualized, maybe $120,000. So Opdivo's sticker price is $150,000 per patient, per year. So tell me how you save on total cost of care to pay for the new drug. Doesn't matter, right? Just, I mean, you can't roll it back enough to justify that cost. Now you say, oh, that's not what it really does. It makes people live longer. And that's, I agree with that. But if you look at the published results, it doesn't cure everybody, right? It cures, well, actually, we don't know if it cures anybody. it prolongs survival by a median of 3 months. So, yeah. So here's the question: are we ready for HTA?
Yeah.
Is HTA what the solution, right? Yeah. And can we use pricing married to HTA?
Define that. Actually.
Okay. So I'm going to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Health technology assessment.
Yeah.
Right. So not it would nice. Right. Nice.
Yeah.
Right. HTA. Now NCCN is de facto HTA, but it's not really, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not. Everybody in this room knows that it's not really HTA. And you know, NICE has done some really cool stuff about, and other European nations that use HTA have done some cool stuff saying if you're new to market, you cannot charge more until you prove you're better.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's a way to control growth and spending.
So one way we're going to do that is actually begin doing real-world comparative effectiveness. As I think everybody in this audience knows, we do use NCCN as our basis for coverage. So if they recommend it, we say, yes, we'll cover it. But that's all we ever know about that drug. We have a little bit of information in the registration trial. Well, now that we're online and we can now get the clinical information we need, when that physician enters the clinical data and up pops the 8 recommended regimens from the NCCN in about 3 years now, you'll see all the results of those regimens for UnitedHealthcare patients.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the total cost of care? What's the percentage of hospitalizations? How long do people actually stay on the drug? There are a number of them where that's going to be a month or less. And as physicians and consumers see that data, they're going to have a little less, I think, enchantment with some of the options that are being offered to them and will probably drop out. I'm hoping that that data will begin to move both patients and physicians away from very low-value regimens. If it doesn't, we may use the data in the long term then to set a tier, to say this one's going to cost you a lot more because it has a lot less value.
I'm going to predict that you're going to need to do that, because ultimately, as long as the healthcare consumer is insulated from the cost completely, which eventually, even if they have a big deductible to get through, as you point out, they blow through it right away, there's still that sense of, if it's more expensive, it must be better, and isn't my insurance great because it's got to cover that. And so I think that we've created almost an addiction to the expensive. And until there's something that transmits some of that cost and pain to either the patient, or it's going to be really complicated if it goes to the doctor, because there's this already large distrust and the sense of, I don't want anything that my doctor could, quote, make more money on me. That's a bad thing. So the idea that the doctor could be rewarded for using a less expensive regimen is the kind of thing that patients are going to have a very, very strong reaction against.
So we've got a lot of perspectives. Before I open it up to the audience, just I'm going to ask the one sort of looking out into the future. And when I ask for looking out in the future, what I'm going to ask about is, when is the future? What we've done in the last couple of years in this panel, and Lee, it was great that you could join us this year, because you, as well as Mike, have actually been innovating and working at models, okay, to address this problem. Too often, I think what we see, to prepare for this and not be completely ignorant about the topic, I just went and read every piece of paper I could about value-based models coming to oncology, episode-based care, indication-based pricing, you know, you name it. You guys have been prolific. And the tone of it is positive, but everybody says, yes, but we can't do this because, okay? We can't do indication-based pricing right now because of this. We can't do episode-based, you know, treatment because of this. We may or may not get comparative effectiveness, and maybe if it's an industry, be careful what you wish for, because maybe the industry would be better off with one of these other systems. So from the trenches, from the real world, the question is, what is the most likely way the bulk of this gets fixed, assuming optimistically it gets fixed, so we're not a buzzkill panel, and how... What is the system that is most likely, realizing that this is the U.S. perspective, what's the system that's most likely to be the most popular and the most sustainable?
The most likely thing is that we push the risk a little bit out of view. And that would be some bundling, ACOs, CMMIs demo, what United's done in a very innovative way, that we use sort of either intermediaries like Pathways or doctors and insurers directly like Anthem is doing, and say, okay, we're not going to talk about price. We're not going to limit coverage. This is the insurer speaking. But we're going to let you guys handle this, and just remember that there's a way to make more money, and it has to do with selecting lower-priced agents. If that happens in narrow buckets, what happens is patients suffer potentially. If it happens broadly, but it can be protected by having guidelines, if it happens broadly, you start to see the market move. And I think that's where we're going to get. The real question is, will Medicare move, or will Medicaid be able to move, or will Medicaid best price mess the whole thing up, or something like that? Medicare is completely hamstrung here. Right? They can't do least costly alternative payments. They can't put two different drugs in the same code. They can't do really basic blocking and tackling. And there's no way they can get a Pathways program. But maybe with the bundling thing, we'll just get it out of view, and then the manufacturers will sort of be aware of market share, and we won't see a lot of what's going on.
So I think we're moving. The fact that we can't do it, to me, is just a kind of a red flag to say, oh, sure I can. So we've quadrupled the number of people in the episodes program. Several hundred a month are now going on. If that data holds up in our second phase, I think we're going to see a significant expansion, at least at our company. And the transparency for comparative effectiveness is already up and running. So we're just accumulating patients. It'll take about 2 years to get mature enough data to start displaying it. But somewhere in the next 2 to 3 years, a consumer is going to be able to go on a site and say, these are how these regimens really perform. And if they don't respond to that data, as my skeptic over here thinks that may be the case, then we will have to put a financial incentive on top of it. Because you don't want to pay for low value. That's wasting a lot of money and resources that we don't have. No one in this country does. So I think we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. I don't feel as negative about it. I think there are lots of alternatives. Will it look like our program? Maybe, maybe not. That isn't important at all. What's more important is that we're now trying these things in a field that was once considered sacred. And it isn't anymore.
Me, skeptical? So I'm skeptical about that. I think that as you think about the amount of transparency that's coming through to patients, that's something new. That's something that you need to look at. That it used to be you could just say there's a significant improvement in survival and everybody would kowtow to it. Now people are actually open to hearing, wait a minute, it's how many days? It adds how much side effect? Before we even get into the cost, people are starting to dig through and say, wait a minute, what did Avastin offer when you added it to my colon cancer regimen and how much extra cost was that? What was my copay, perhaps? People are seeing this. So, you know, they're starting to look at the Kaplan-Meier curves, and they're saying, wait a minute, they're all kind of dropping, aren't they? I thought it meant it was going to go across. I thought I was going to be fine. So the expectations that have been built in the marketing of oncology in general to patients are starting to come home to roost because they're looking at what's really been delivered, and they're not satisfied. And the industry, all of us, are going to carry water for what we've done over the past two decades because, as has been said this morning, we're starting to see some more substantial advances.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more substantial than what we were mostly able to offer before. They're still much less substantial than what most of the consumers out there in their minds think are being offered. Everybody thinks immuno-oncology is cured cancer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I should be planning longer vacations. It's a problem solved. But unfortunately, we all know that when we're done with those immuno-oncologic drugs, probably then people are going to go back and use exactly what we're using today before those with all those same costs, and it's really just going to be adding on to the pile.
It's consumerism. And it's, as Lena's pointing out here, I think very well, consumers are getting far more engaged in those decisions at multiple levels than they used to. And that's going to, I think, change the market because they're going to look at some of the, quote, value being offered out there and be very, very skeptical. And it's mostly the guys at this table. The baby boomers that are beginning to age in and starting to have the cancers are the same people that tore up college campuses many years ago and changed a lot of different markets. They're going to look at it the same way.
From Peter's analogy at the beginning about the party, I assume he tore up a few campuses, too. I'm not sure where that came from.
So let's not confuse care delivery reform with the topic of this panel. Care delivery reform is proceeding. It's going to result in better care for patients, more accountability for physicians, consumerism around quality providers. But that's got nothing to do with the cost of these drugs. So we will see changes in delivery. But it's really hard to imagine how the cost of drugs fits into those care delivery reforms. In fact, in my opinion, and Peter and I have debated this, I think they are outside,
but
which is to say it has to be approached by a different mechanism. And I think you are asking, you, as in you, the people who price these drugs, are asking the payers to behave like payers, which you really don't like. So if there are 7 or 8 PD-1 drugs, we will treat them as a class.
Mm-hmm.
We will treat them as a class. And then you will compete on price or you will not compete on price. So you'll have to develop some way to distinguish yourselves because we will select on price if they're all pretty much the same. We will treat them that way. We will use pathways, whether you want to call them pathways or a clinical portal with differential for, it doesn't matter. It's some presentation to the provider point of care regarding value-driven choices.
and I have no problem rewarding a provider for making a value-driven choice if the therapeutic options are equivalent. I don't know why people, why do people get upset that we reward a value-driven choice? We're actually de facto rewarding a non-value-driven choice because of ASP or a hospital fee schedule-based reimbursement. We actually reward them for choosing a higher priced one already.
Thank you.
And right. And that's the other thing that's going to happen. This will happen. There will be a cap on what the margin is going to be, and that's going to happen fast because there is a huge site of service differential. Getting a HER2 new positive patient walk in your office should not be the equivalent of getting a lottery ticket. That is just obscene. Right, that's just nuts in an ASP plus six world. That's exactly what it is. So there's something wrong with that.
But just we want to stay on that, and I promise I will get to the questions. I hear what you're saying, Mike, but I'm also thinking what I'm hearing from Lee, what I'm hearing from Len about patients and about them starting to make decisions. I'm hearing, I haven't heard the word transparency spoken yet on this panel, but it's in a lot of the literature, that we're actually going to be more transparent about value. So is it really just about the fact that the prices are too high? Do we even know? Okay. Because I don't think it's necessarily, I'll push back a little, I don't actually think it's a separate discussion. I think it's all wrapped up if we can get a better sense, because I'm hearing what Len is saying in the way patients are measuring value. We just don't have the tools yet.
On the issue of are prices too high, I mean, obviously that's in the eye of the beholder to some extent. But as you know, we've been tracking this, tracked it back to 1965. After you adjust for consumer-level inflation, or the CPI, there's been a 100-fold increase in the introductory price of cancer drugs for a month of treatment since 1965. That's, again, adjusted for inflation. So either prices were 100-fold too cheap in 1965 or they're 100-fold too high. You may think, okay, fine, but that's the magnitude of the benefit, which means cancer drugs are 100 times more effective than they were in 1965. We've actually tested that hypothesis. We have a paper in the Journal of Economic Perspective that there's an NBER working paper that goes with it. This is what we found, and I may have to say this a couple times. The cost of an additional life year for a new cancer drug each year goes up by $8,500, which means that if a drug gets introduced this year and it gives a year of life, it will cost $8,500 more on average than some other cancer drug that was introduced last year and gave an additional year of life. That inflation since 1995 is equal to a year of life being $50,000 in 95 and $250,000 today. So prices are going up relative to what the benefits are. We don't include some of the new IOs, but we've already looked at the data, and because prices are rising so quickly, there is no way you can extrapolate from what we're seeing, for example, with Opdivo and get to any conclusion, and that, too, is highly inefficient with respect to prices even from 20 years ago.
Yeah, and as you said, that's the way the market's set up, so we shouldn't be surprised. We're getting exactly what we asked for.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Anybody questions from the audience? I want to give our mic runners a workout. I can't believe that.
By the way, really? Comparative effectiveness is transparency. I want to clarify that point. Yeah. You were saying there wasn't any, but I think there will be.
Okay.
So. And I'll clarify too. I'm not skeptical about bundles and what you're doing at all. I think that is where we're going to head. And I think the risk is not what you guys have done, where you nested in pathways, you had clarification, so you didn't have skimping. But I think if it's a more sort of top-down, the further you get from observing care, the further you get from even knowing the population and the risk factors, the much riskier it is that there'll just be stuff going on that we'll never observe that will be bad for patients. Yeah. At the end of the day, we want this biomedical innovation. We want Opdivo.
Right.
I'm not pimping for that drug, but we want that to get to patients, that benefit. The problem is we need to be able to afford it.
Yeah, that's a question, I think. Does somebody have a microphone?
I do, but there we go.
I apologize. This room is hard to see.
Yeah, so you guys have been talking a lot about predictive biomarkers, and I think you have Opdivo, which has efficacy in maybe 30% of patients. But there's been a whole string of papers in Nature and Science, et cetera, that really show there are potential biomarkers that can pick out, maybe not perfectly, but can pick out who probably should and shouldn't be taking Nevo. And the question is, how do we how do we fix the diagnostic market to allow this to progress in the sense that, I mean, there's no barrier to entry in the diagnostic market. There's no protection against, once you have that, the value you get for a diagnostic is almost nothing. There's something broken about that market. And if you want predictive biomarkers, which you, I mean, the amount of money you could drop out of the system would be, for paying for Nevo would be enormous. But how do you get there?
Yeah, I think that you're right about being broken. You're right about being a sort of a poor commodity. It's a poorly regulated space. It's probably the case that these things should be attached better to drugs, and that, you know, that's something the FDA started to do, and then it's sort of, they're going to sort of backpedal a little. But I think that's one of the potentials. A clarification, I embarrassed to continue to say positive things about Bristol's drug Opdivo, but it's not correct that it only helps 30%. There was a change at the median, which means that more than 50% of the patients at least got a prolonged survival. All right, so you were talking about the tail of the distribution, which is underpowered, but this is an effective agent in probably a fairly large population.
But to address your question, I think one of the problems that we have in oncology is we are so used to using drugs that don't work. It's in our DNA. And so the idea that we don't use it in somebody at the very bottom of the curve is anathema to us. It's like, well, we have to give each person, quote, their chance. We're used to this sort of herd mentality where we look at the median as the reasonable chance and forget that the person at the very bottom of the curve had next to no chance. It was a lottery ticket kind of thing. So if we can reach some point where we say below X performance, we won't use a drug, that would be a huge step forward. The only reason that RAS mutations are an exclusionary marker is that people don't understand that there are a few patients out there that actually have documented RAS mutations and have responded. They're vanishingly rare, and they came up after the mindset got set. Otherwise, there'd be all this backlash of how can you take it away from people. Mm-hmm. So we've got to get to the idea where when we say we do this enormous study and we find that there's this median benefit and that median benefit is good, if we can look at the people at the bottom X percent, 10%, 20% of the curve and see, well, actually those people got such little benefit that if we just did a study on them, we'd never approve this drug, then make the step and say, therefore, we won't approve it or we'll unapprove it for those people. That's going to be a difficult idea to sell, but I think a necessary one.
I have some questions. Go ahead.
We'll the idea that a test has to make money is foolish. Like, just think about it for a second, really. What you want to do is have the test distinguish your product, but your product is the drug, not the test. And people developing LDTs that mirror the test that was registered in conjunction with the agent, the companion diagnostic, actually, as long as it performs, will ultimately improve your market. The problem really is that if we have 8 PD-1s, people are going to assume that the biomarker applies to all of them. Mm-hmm. What I'm suggesting to you is think again. Mm-hmm. Think again. That may actually be a very easy way for a payer to say, we'll pay for this drug because we got a biomarker that tells us who's going to benefit. Just think about that for a second.
I'm also... as I get deeper and deeper into the biomarker market, getting a little skeptical in that, we keep hearing that there's no protection, but there's also no transparency. The way we are charged for those tests is very obscure. They basically charge us for the processes they use. They never label the actual intent of the test. And there's lots of rhetoric about we should change that because it's not good, but nothing ever happens. So we've started having our entire artificial intelligence geeks take a look at that space, and we're finding a number of labs. Actually, just saw this data last week. We have labs billing us with in excess of 2,500 combinations of CPT codes for exactly the same test, and then they mathematically figure out where they got the maximum payment and use that as their source. You can just see it in several different laboratories and several different tests that it's a very conscious mechanism to maximize their revenue, and they do really well. Take that mythology or that common wisdom with a little grain of salt.
Is that the first application of big data in healthcare?
It actually is.
So, I think we have a question patiently waiting in the back there. Yep.
We are not ignoring biomarkers for Opdivo. We are actively and diligently testing a PD-L1 biomarker in our frontline non-small cell lung cancer trial. And it just takes time. It takes time to read out. You can't just wish for a biomarker. You have to test it. And you have to test it in a phase 3 trial.
Do you have the blocks on some of your original work that you go back and just do a quick look to see if it seems like it might work? Right? Isn't that what they do in Sweden and stuff?
If we did not think that there was a probability it would work, we wouldn't be testing in the phase 3 trial. But everything has to be tested. This is evidence-based.
Yeah, there's this retrospective, prospective thing that's available, right? We all know that.
I think one also has to be very careful in these discussions to define works.
Yeah.
If it's got to be 100%, I will predict that you won't find it any time in our lifetimes. If we're going to be able to say, all right, working less benefit or X amount of benefit less than 5% of the time or some reasonable criteria whereby we could exclude a population of patients, that's useful. If a marker is just being used to include additional patients outside the indication, that's not helpful to the discussion.
Yeah, I think the guy who put us together is a lot smarter than we give him credit for. The New England Journal article where we're looking at the order of the genes, why are any of us surprised at that? Nothing in a biologic system is simple, and one biomarker is never going to be the complete answer.
Okay, so in the interest of staying on time, some people here have super-duper hard stops. I want to keep the meeting running, too. Any other questions? We'll take one more question, and then I'll ask the panelists to kind of give some closing thoughts and wrap up, looking forward to how this discussion will advance, perhaps by next year. Okay, question.
So maybe a two-part question, but, yeah, I see I'm a big proponent of cost-effectiveness and looking at value-based approaches towards the total cost of healthcare. And I see here that the incentives are perverse, that patient outcomes are not tied towards reimbursements, towards the total cost. And I think that both hospitals, pharma companies, pharma benefit managers all have shareholders, and they've got a profit margin that they've got to protect, that they've got responsibilities to maximize. So one question is earlier you mentioned that drugs make up maybe 20-25% of healthcare costs, but yet the conversation seems to be 90% of the conversation is around drug costs. So why is that? Why aren't we really discussing the overall cost of the problem and focusing on drugs? And secondly, how do we, the discussion revolved around these little solutions, nipping at the problem, but how do we really address the key problem to align, the reimbursement cost to patient outcomes? Because really they seem divergent, mm-hmm. and it needs a really big answer.
That's exactly why we built the episodes program. The only way a physician could get a raise going forward with that program was to improve the outcome of the patient. So those outcomes included better survival, which, say, a lung cancer drug may help now. The other option was you lower the total cost of care for that patient. Total cost. Everything is measured. And that's what they did. So I do think there are programs like that beginning to emerge. That means fee-for-service goes away. And for, I think, our government services, that's going to be a very difficult leap. But in the private space, there are a number of projects and experiments going on that have done that. And when we did it, we saw a huge reduction in the total cost of care, most of which came from hospitals, by the way, not pharmaceuticals. Just a correction on that fact, that 25% of budget is for cancer care, not our total health care budget for all illnesses.
So I'm just going to, in the interest of wrapping up, just ask the panelists for any closing thoughts, and we can go right to left in case Peter, you really got his thing out. So.
No, I don't. Thank you for having me, and I think, this is going to be a very interesting time period, and I think that if we could move to a value-based system, I don't know what that is exactly. I think the components of value are probably ones that everyone could agree with. It's just a question of the weighting of those components, and that would be, I think that probably would be good for everyone.
Mike?
It's everyone's problem. Everyone is part of the problem, and everybody can be part of the solution. It's a great time to be bullish on innovation. I think if we keep our eye on the ball, which is getting the right treatment to the right patient, it'll turn out okay.
Yeah,
Yeah, I think it's balanced. So I'm very optimistic about the future. The last thing we want to see is innovation stop. But as we innovate, it does mean we have to parse out those things that have less value. They have to go. And in a profession that's steeped in tradition, that's a very difficult task. But we're going to have to do that and get rid of the unnecessary, the low value, in order to make room for the new.
I'm going to close by answering Eric's question and also just a general comment that I probably would have made anyway. Don't take your eye off the ball. Healthcare costs too much. Many, if not all, areas of healthcare are going to undergo downsizing and cost reduction. Your issue is the cost of drugs. Don't distract from that issue by talking about other things that we can do. And my final comment is, deal with it. Your drugs cost too much. You're going to have to confront that.
All right. With that, I'm going to thank the panel. These guys are incredibly busy, and they're in the forefront of attempting to solve a problem, and it's not easy. And I want to thank all of them for their contributions and for coming today. And Peter had to run, but thank you to everybody. Thanks.